Everyone, welcome to Innov and Crea. Today, our guest is Chris Wells. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is going to be a very interesting and I think passionate subject that we're going to address. So, Chris, you're the founder of the Dabrowski Center and your co-host of the podcast, The Positive Disintegration Podcast with Emma Nicholson.
That's right.
So today we are going to talk about the positive disintegration theory that was elaborated by Dabrowski. And the reason why I wanted to talk about it on Innov and Crea is, to me, there are similarities between the theory and the creative process. And I think that it might be very insightful for artists, inventors, innovators, creators, anybody who kind of question things, mostly the status quo, to learn about the positive disintegration theory, because there might, on one end, I think there might be insights on how you work as a person, why you are the way you are. And also, I see links between some of the steps in the creative process. It's a complex theory, so everyone will we have the expert to tell us about it. And it's really, I think, a matter of just diving into the rabbit hole like Alice did and just enjoy the discovery of the theory. I always ask my guests the root question, which is, when you were 10 years old, why were you passionate? What were you, you know, interested or fascinated about?
I'm glad that I was prepared for this question because it was honestly hard to think of how to answer it. Because, like, for one thing, when I was young, I mean, I was passionate and interested in a lot of different things, but some of my passions were healthier than others. And of course, all of this ties back to the theory. So I was interested in computers and writing. I was passionate about medicine, but I also had this long-standing interest in death and also drugs. And so these things were all going on for me when I was young and really created a lot of problems for me.
And that's interesting, because even the topic of death being fascinating or curious about what it means and all this is also part of the theory. You know,
that's right.
There you go. So how did you go from, you know, being a child or a teenager and you know, questioning all this to having a PhD and having discovered the theory? What's the link? How did you get there?
Right. So the link was that I went through a long period in my 20s of being in mental health treatment and thinking that I was mentally ill. Well, because I was so different and because I just really struggled to fit into the world, I went through times where I really felt like maybe I was an alien and I had been just dropped here and I was waiting for somebody to help me and take me to my home planet. So I went through all of that, and, you know, I came out of that before I was in my 30s, but, you know, then I went into social work, and then I was actually in my PhD program when I discovered the theory.
Okay.
And it was just this enormous revelation that it wasn't mental illness that I was struggling with, and that it was this whole reframe of my whole life, and going from feeling like there had always been something wrong with me to realizing that it wasn't that there was something wrong with me, and that I just was, you know, somebody who had been through this process of transformation so many times.
And so you became very interested in the theory. Can you tell us just your work? Because you just founded the Dabrowski Center and you have a mission behind it.
That's right. Yeah. So I talk about passion. I mean, all of the things that I just named about being passionate when I was young, I feel like none of them hold a candle to, well, except for writing, the passion that I've had for this theory and studying it and applying it and bringing it to other people. And it's because I see how powerful it is to have this reframe first, of course, the work was studying the theory and learning it, trying to understand it inside out, learning the texts, you know, learning what Dombrowski said, learning what Michael Bihofsky said, learning what other scholars who've studied the theory wrote about, understanding the research. But then I was writing about it, and then I was wanting to apply it in practice. And so I went and got my licensure as a social work and started a private practice. And so I work with adults, and I work, using the theory as my perspective, the main perspective, mm-hmm. although of course I bring in other theoretical perspectives as well. But yeah, so that's where I am now, where I founded the center because there's no home for the theory other than a website that Bill Tillier has that offers information. But there's no center, or there wasn't a place where you could search for help and resources. And that's my vision. And also wow. to build community. And so all of that is a part of it.
And to sort of collect all the works that were created from people who studied with Dombrowski or studied this theory. And so you're trying to gather all this in one home. I love the image of that.
Right, right. So yeah, that's what I've been trying to do. And it's been an enormous project.
Let's start by talking about Dombrowski. So Dombrowski was a Polish psychiatrist and psychologist, was born in 1902, died in 1980. And he came up with this theory. Now, after that, I'll let you tell us what it is. Now, my context around it, because I think that Gustav Jung would love the synchronicity of it all. So I'm from Quebec City, and my dad in the 70s studied psychology at Université Laval, Laval University, where Dombrowski was teaching in the 70s. And not that many people know that, right? So back then, he spent a lot of time in Edmonton, if I recall, in Europe, in the States as well.
No, not in the States too. No, I mean, he worked in the States in the 30s, just briefly.
Oh, there you go. Okay. And he studied, he taught psychology here. And my dad did his master's degree on the theory, on the positive disintegration theory. Now, growing up, I heard the name Dombrowski here and there. But as a kid, you're like, yeah, whatever. And fast forward, in 2012, I decided to go back to school to do a master's degree in design, in human-centered design. I go to London. And funny enough, the program I was part of, mainly the school, Central Saint Martins, is known for not teaching you anything, for bringing you to a point where you unlearn what you knew, so that you can bring new knowledge to light. Initially, my plan was on a very specific subject, and it was talking about the ecology in the arts and crafts movement at the end of the 19th century in England. So it was very that's what I was interested in about. But for some crazy reasons, life brought me to a place where I actually found out that I was gifted through pre-searching my subject. And so that was a huge shock because I had no idea. I was 37 by then. And I decided to do my MA project on giftedness, most specifically on the asynchronous development in gifted children. So that's another theory by Terassi. And I was talking to my dad and I was doing my research, and he's like, yeah, but of course. And then he tells me that basically, I'm a product of the theory in many ways. I was born in 75. He graduated in 75. So people can do the maths. And I just think it's fascinating. It's like a full circle. But I never stopped studying giftedness and mentoring people that would be what Paula Prober calls the rainforest mind. So probably more the artistic. People discover their neurodiversity and need just to talk about it, because it's quite mind-boggling when you find that out. You suddenly it makes sense, but it can be a shock as well. And so that's how Dombrowski is part of my life. And what I think that we need to put in context with the theory is, in the 70s, I was, I guess, developed, but I was told that it actually disappeared a bit in the 80s and was picked up in the 90s, mostly by people researching giftedness. So for the people listening, we won't necessarily dive into neurodiversity or giftedness, But that's why we might make a reference between the two. And I think it's still important to know. So if people already know that about themselves, they can check out the links I'll put in the show notes about the theory. People who have suddenly like a light bulb moment, then, you know, you can reach out to me or Chris. So can you bring us to how the theory came up and what it is, please? It's complex, but it's positive. That's the whole point of it.
Well, I'll do my best. It's so hard to talk about the theory. Like, you know, like you mentioned, I have a podcast called Positive Disintegration, and it was so difficult in the first episode to describe the theory and explain where it came from. It's so hard, but I'll do my best. So the theory really came from Dombrowski's interest in understanding suffering. Just because of the times in which he grew up, you know, living through World War I and World War II, and the personal experiences he had, losing a sister to meningitis when they were children, losing one of his closest friends to suicide. Sorry for my dog barking. So these experiences of loss and suffering in his early life really, you know, led him to want to know where it came from, where it led people, you know. And also he wanted to know the differences between the different kinds of people. People who are good and people who, you know, are not.
Who might create the suffering.
Yeah, exactly.
Versus some people who actually help healing it.
That's right.
You know?
That's right. Mm. So he was really interested in the whole range of humanity in some ways. And the theory reflects that. But he especially looked at the difference between what he called a unilevel and a multilevel perception of reality. Most people, he said, are on like this unilevel way of existing or live in this plane of existence where they don't have a hierarchy of values, which is how he phrased it. The people who did have a multi-level experience of reality did have this hierarchy of values. They saw a higher versus a lower in themselves. And, you know, and he saw it in everything. Like this idea of multi-levelness is a foundational construct in the theory. And it's something that like really pervades everything that he talked about. Values were hugely important to him.
And the theory is the idea that there might be events in your life that might come as a shock. It can be an illness, it can be grief, it can be, you know, losing your job, anything that disrupts the current life that you have. And well, I guess you'll have a choice. Either you use it and you victimize yourself, or you're like, oh, wait a second. It makes a breach and I consider something else possible. There are other possibilities for myself or for how you experience life. And there are levels in the theory.
It's interesting to me because just listening to you describe it, I've been really going out of my way to not talk about the levels so much and to talk about the processes within them. And so let me think about how to do it. Like, so people who are in unilevel development versus multilevel in the theory, they don't have the same experience of what he called dynamisms. It's hard to even capture in this brief amount of time. It's a very conceptually rich theory. So there are a lot of constructs and, you know, they all are related to each other. But let me go back to his early work. So
yes.
So when he was first studying and becoming a physician and a psychologist, he worked in his work in the US, actually, he worked with children. And so he was a child psychiatrist at the time. And so you know that he was working with children who were institutionalized. These were children who had a wide range of mental conditions, all kinds of things at the time that we didn't have they didn't have the DSM, right? Like now,
yes,
we would label these children as autistic, ADHD, OCD, depressed, like a variety of things. But he also saw how trauma impacted children. So like the experience of positive disintegration, you know, comes from, well, a variety of things, but he saw like these five overexcitabilities. And so children who were very nervous, because nervousness is the word that they used at the time too, to describe this, they were very sensitive. They had this experience of sensitivity that was beyond the norm. They had like a lowered threshold for stimuli and a heightened responsiveness to it. And so they reacted to things that other people maybe didn't react. Mm-hmm. So again, oh my gosh, it feels like so daunting to try to describe. But so there are certain developmental periods. And so the children that he worked with, you know, he could see that in puberty, they went through a time of kind of a breakdown of their structure of who they were. And that's when you might see dynamisms in children. Well, you may see them even outside of developmental periods. And like guilt and shame are dynamisms, but there are also like ambivalences. And, you know, there are so many. Oh my gosh. Well, there are like 29 or 30 of them, actually.
How many overexcitability?
5. Psychomotor, sensual, intellectual, imaginational, and emotional. And emotional was the most important. And it's really like the most critical to have this multi-level development. You don't have a multi-level process in this theory unless you have strong emotional overexcitability.
And then the values that go with it and the capacity to change your own status quo. That's how I was seeing a bridge and a link with the creative process, because in the field of the arts or innovation, that's mainly what our job is, is to challenge the status quo. And that is terribly difficult because we go back to the fact that although people or in companies or organizations want change on a very individual level, it's very difficult as a human being to want change. And so you need people who have this capacity to hold it, to be able to accompany and stand that stress. But it also means that you take a chance in making something different that might not work the first time. And then you go back. And I think that's what's so interesting is the idea of reviewing a status. Is this working? No, it doesn't work. Whether it's from Dabrowski's theory or in the creative process, the idea is you have a statement of a situation that doesn't work out anymore. And what do you change? Do you sit in it or do you decide to change it and investigate it? The moments where you go through disintegration might be like growing pains.
Well, for sure, it's growing pains. He saw that people who had these overexcitabilities were more prone to going through the process of positive disintegration and that it could propel them through it. But like you said, it can be a really painful and difficult process. And so while you're in it, it feels like suffering. You know, you're maybe having these experiences of anxiety and depression, but he didn't see them as something wrong with you.
Exactly.
You know, and
it was an opportunity.
That's right. It was an opportunity for growth. For example, I'm thinking of like imaginational overexcitability will allow you to have the vision of who you could become. You know, and this is something that I experienced. Like when I was young, I always had like this experience of like an imaginal world where I had there was another Chris like in my mind. And I could see how I could be in my relationships, in my life. Well, it didn't always align with how I really was in my real life, but it was a place in my inner world where I could kind of experiment and see like how things could go, right? And then apply that in my actual life. And so it almost for me was like a kind of rehearsal in my imagination of the real world that I could then apply. And this is the kind of thing he talked about of, you know, having like a personality ideal and reaching for it and then living it. And that's the thing about the levels is that at the higher levels in the theory, you're living your values and you're your authentic self instead of being who, you know, society led you to believe you should be.
That's why I find it so interesting. And I see the links with creativity or creative work is that your job is not to conform. It's to challenge, and most people who do these jobs, they do not fit in because that's not what their job is. And the pressure is so huge of fitting in, of not questioning. You know, how many people are like, oh, they ask too many questions. Well, yeah, but if you want something new, then you have to do something differently than what you did before to achieve a different result. And so you need the casting, the people when it can actually do that sort of work. You're not crazy, basically.
Right.
The idea is it might be an opportunity for you to go through rebirths, to accept, to shed some layers of conformity that might have been forced on you because, you know, we all kind of have to go through this, to peel it off so you can be your best self.
I mean, technically, most people are at level one. And these are people who don't ever go through the process of positive disintegration. These are people who are able to conform and who just live their lives, right? And so then the next place in the theory, like level two, is unilevel disintegration. And so unilevel disintegration is actually very uncomfortable. And it often comes through in like somatic complaints. You know, maybe you have migraines, or maybe you have some other issues like ulcers, or, you know, we would call them like psychosomatic issues too, like all of that stuff. And really what it is like a disconnection between your awareness, like maybe you're having some stress or tension in your life and it's manifesting in your body instead of you having an awareness of it.
So yeah, physical ailments. Do you investigate whether they are physiological really, or are they psychosomatic? And so you kind of have two paths. Now, if you don't investigate the possibility that they're psychosomatic, then you're going to stay at level one. You're just going to be kind of stuck there possibly. If you investigate, then you might do the work. And it might be very painful to go from one to two, because I presume that that's the realization where you actually don't fit in.
It's hard to say how many people go from one to two in the theory, you know, but it's a huge shift to go from that. And of course, you know, there are a lot of arguments among the many people who have studied and talked about the theory. Michael Pihofsky does not believe that you can start from level one and get to level five in one lifetime. He just doesn't think it happens that way. And I incline to agree that most people, that's not how it works. You know, I think that a lot of, and this is a connection with the gifted field. If you have a certain cognitive capacity in childhood, you are experiencing dynamisms from a young age. You know, you have the ability to see what's wrong in the people in your life. You're more likely to question your teacher. You're more likely to see all of the things that are wrong in the world, to see past people's pretenses. And so these children are having a different experience than children who are just accepting what they're told, and they're listening in class, and there's, you know, they're not questioning what they're being told. They're just saying, oh, okay, I better just study this and remember it and get it right on the test.
And they're not disruptive, because I think that the values such as justice, fairness, integrity, these are values that even in kids, they will point it out, and they might point it out to authority. And people in authority are not going to like that, and they're going to put it on the child as a behavior defect or whatever, when really this kid might actually, there might be problem with behavior. I'm not saying that doesn't exist, but I'm saying that instead, if you look at it on the developmental angle through the theory, this kid is actually going through a process of disintegration by naming it, but not having maybe the capacity to materialize it.
Right. Well, and you know, another thing that I think is worth saying is that there's not only one kind of giftedness. Like, there's not only one way for that to look. So there's emotional giftedness. There's visual, there's artistic giftedness. There's musical giftedness. There's physical giftedness. All of these domains. And they're not mutually exclusive. You can be intellectually gifted and be, you know, a brilliant musician or an athlete or artistic. There's so much overlap. And like in the heart piece, though, is what matters. And so if you have, again, like without that strong emotional overexcitability, you're not going to go through the process of positive disintegration like he laid it out. So this is really a theory. When people ask me for like a one, like, what is this theory about? Give me like two words. I'll say it's a theory of inner transformation. So that's what it's all about. It's about transforming yourself. It's about growth and development. But unfortunately, you can grow up as a child and have these early dynamisms and then go back to a more rigid state. Like level one. So over during this summer, we had at the Dabrowski Congress, we had Melissa Bernstein was there, and she talked about, you know, growing up and having like a multi-level nuclei, Dabrowski would call it, but going back in terms of levels, and like she became like caught up in what people thought of her, and, you know, and she wasn't able to be her authentic self until she was an adult. And so you can totally you know, go from different places in this yes. theory. Like it's not a linear progression. It's very dynamic.
And it's dynamic. Could we say that it's more sort of, instead of being like linear, it's more of like a spiral kind of thing?
That's so,
because you go back. And to me, there's also the idea of transforming yourself. For me, it feels like you would become somebody else, when really what it is about is finding your true self, is reaching towards your true self. So it's transforming, but it's within what you already have, who you really are.
That's right, like discovering your essence.
Exactly. And I think it's often used, but the idea of the cocoon and the butterfly and the pupa is interesting, because all this existed from the get-go and then transformed into something, but not something, it didn't become a squirrel, you know, it's still a butterfly, and the essence of who you are is still that. And it's more like, I would like to say owning it and then honing it.
Well, and that's his third factor, dynamism, is what you're describing. It's okay. And it's on this path to authenticity, you are discovering your real self. And it's really, you know, I like to think of it as, you know, you're like affirming and you're accepting and you're nurturing the parts of yourself that feel more yourself or that you want to be, right? And you're rejecting. And you're letting go, not only rejecting, yes. but you're just letting go of the parts of yourself that aren't you. And so this is something that, you know, would be a lifelong process, really, to getting to who you really are. And on our podcast, we say that, you know, it's you're on your path to your authentic self. And that's, and we keep telling,
actually,
like,
that's
keep
probably
walking
the best. That's the best elevator pitch that you can serve for someone who asks you what the theory is about.
Right.
Because that's really what it is about. And I wanted to just touch for a moment on what five is. So just for people to figure it, you know, there are levels and it's complex. And I think that people studying the theory also have their own theory on the theory. So then you're kind of, that's why I was talking about a rabbit hole. So when we talk about five, and tell me if I'm wrong in thinking that, but basically people going up in the spiral, let's say like that, at disintegration, they serve the world. It's like going towards working for the better good of humanity. That's what it feels like. So people that would be at five, we would name like Mother Teresa, Gandhi, or
Jesus. That's right. Peace Pilgrim, yes. is another person who was at level five. And, you know, again, like from the elevator pitch perspective, if you asked me, like, what's the difference between one and five? Mm. One is egocentric. It's more self-oriented. And five is other-centered. You know, it's... he called it alterocentrism, but you are working for the betterment of humanity.
Altruistic.
It's altruistic. It's outside of yourself. You have a goal outside of yourself and you are living your values. Exactly, embody it. I think of like the Dalai Lama. People talk about how when you're in the Dalai Lama's presence, you feel his presence, you know, like that. He, like, because he has spent his whole life doing this work for others. And you can't help but feel that from him. And I think that that's the quality when you reach the highest level, that you're like, you're just embodying it.
Could we say that you become sort of a conduit for good?
I would say so. I think love is like a key thing that is present. Like, and this is now, I'm at the point where I am wanting to theorize and say what connections I see. Like, love is so important.
Because it's the antidote to fear. And I believe, for what I read, is every moment, or if it, I'd say every opportunity for disintegration has to do with facing your fear. And every time that you manage to say, okay, instead of running away from it, facing it, see what's behind it, and then leaving it behind and moving on, accepting that you were once fearful about this and that, and that you integrated your fears as well. Not in that you become them, but in that you demystified them. And you kind of go through them through a process of loving yourself more, so discovering yourself more.
You have to love yourself if you're going to love other people. It's interesting. Mm. And love, of course, is another thing that you can look at through levels. And of course, Dombrowski did that. But yeah, I mean, what love looks like in a person at a higher level compared to a lower level is so different. I've thought a lot about this. I read a lot. I just met with somebody this week and I was describing to him how I read all of these books about love while I was studying the theory. It was actually 5 years ago at this time. And one of the books that I read when I was trying to understand love and its connection with the theory was this book, The Ways and Power of Love by P.T. Sorokin. And it's so fascinating because he, like, it's this the whole book about like levels of love and the impact of love. And it just,
oh, wow.
Like there are all of these interesting connections, but yeah, when you're working and operating from a place of true love, that's right. You don't have fear. And so interestingly, like stories about Peace Pilgrim, who Michael Pihofsky studied, you know, she was like walking for peace. Right. And she was doing her work as a pilgrim for peace, like operating from a place of love. And so she wasn't afraid that she wasn't going to have a place to stay, or she wasn't going to have enough food to eat, or that people were going to hurt her, because she had this unceasing
trust.
Yes. Like she had this contact with like cosmic consciousness, you know, and she had a trust and a faith that were unshakable. And it's that inner peace. So inner peace is another thing that you see at the highest level. Like that is another characteristic that you see in people who have reached that place. So yeah, I can tell you that I do not have inner peace. I still find myself disturbed about a lot of things in my day to day. And I'll know I've reached that place when I, you know, have this unshakable inner peace and trust that I can say that I don't have right now.
Can someone be disintegrating part of themselves to different levels?
We're multidimensional beings. And so for sure, that's true. And I think actually that one of the things that's so wonderful about Dombrowski's theory compared to the medical model in psychiatry is that the medical model is very reductionist. It's not multidimensional, really. But in this theory, yeah, I mean, you can be breaking down certain aspects of yourself or elements while building up and creating new aspects of yourself that are, you know, taking you to where you need to be. And so instead of looking at it as, again, like there's something wrong with you, you're like, oh, yes, like this feels like a struggle right now. But you can see that you can get to the other side of it. You can become somebody or a new version of yourself. I like what you're saying about that you're not becoming a new person. Because that does imply, and yet, you know, it can feel that way. Like I have to say that I totally feel like a different person than I was when I was young. But yeah. I know that my essence has been here all along.
By disintegrating positively, then you're able to just carry more people along a path of transformation and therefore of better good. You want to better the world through new processes, new ideas, new way of thinking, new ways of doing things. You have to do that yourself first and own everything that you are or are not. And so I think the theory is a very cool way to start.
That's right. And it's so key to have that drive for self-knowledge, to keep digging, to keep trying to figure out who you are, to have that awareness. It's a big deal. And it's not easy. Like I can tell you that I have spent years and years peeling back the layers of my life and trying to understand like who I really am. But it's been worth it. You know, for one thing, doing that and going through that process of like critical self-examination really helped me heal a lot of the traumas of my past. You know, it helped me heal relationship traumas. It helped me see things more clearly. It helped me get a better understanding of who I really am. And it helped me move forward to grow. And so I think that I am so grateful that you asked me to come on, because personally, I see this process of inner transformation as a creative one, you know, in some ways, you know, kind of like I said to you before we started today, kind of like the coolest creative process you can go through is
absolutely
like uncovering and being who you really are.
And I'm totally with you on that. It's absolutely uncomfortable. Sometimes you think, well, I'd love not to have to deal with that. Must be nice to be just carefree and not think about, you know, your car polluting or, you know, how we're going to eat in 10 years or, you know, like the sensitivities and excitabilities. But this is my path. And the other thing that I think personally is key in this process, it's gratitude, but it's being able to recognize the people that are put on your path to help you through these discoveries. And I see them and I close my eyes, I see these people, and I wouldn't be the person I am now if life hadn't put them on my path, whether they were tough encounters or healing or helpful encounters. It's such a rich path to take on, but it requires a lot of courage. And yes, you might lose people you love through this process, but you will gain people who understand the path that you're on. It is positive disintegration, but it's an uplifting theory that he's presenting and offered to the world. So I don't know what level he's at, but you know, that's quite a lot of goodness that he's created. But it's full of hope, but you have to do the work.
You do. That's right. It takes effort. I mean, it's the work of inner transformation. It doesn't come easy. That's for sure. It's in Dabrowski. Yeah. He said that this, it was hard won, but yeah, there's a community of people. Like that's the thing. Like there are a community of people at this point who know this theory, who work with it, who live it. And so there are places to find others who are like you if this resonates, for sure.
But it's not that different from a creative process. How many times will you destroy your work until you actually get to something that it's close enough to what you want and you're ready to share it? But it is all about disintegration and unlearning.
Well, he saw a link too. I mean, he was clearly interested in creative people and what they went through. It's certainly one of the populations that were most interesting to him.
Oh,
were artists and musicians, you know, and I mean, he also clearly was interested in like priests, you know, and so it wasn't only creative people, but he
spirituality.
Just, that's right.
Creativity,
there's a huge connection with spirituality too. And so that's important to say.
And that's something that you're actually diving more into, if I'm not mistaken, right? So the realm of how the theory applies to spirituality.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, it's really clear to me that there's a lot of overlap between the what we look at as the spiritual path and Dabrowski's theory. He really took this spiritual path and, well, Michael has said he's translated it into a psychological theory, and it's true. Mm. And so much of the reasons why people go to, you know, therapists or psychiatrists is that they're lost. And I don't think that they realize that there are these spiritual connections. A lot of people shut that aspect of themselves down and they just don't even want to go there. But the fact is, like, if you have, it's, you could see it as like a blockage even that you have to unblock in order to be who you really are.
What do you see for the theory in the future, either in how it evolves or how it's applied, or what would you love to see or something like that?
Oh, I would love to see it applied much more broadly than it has been. It's been kind of constrained, you know, as you said, it kind of was lost for, you know, around the time when he died in 1980, that's exactly when it was being introduced to the field of gifted education. And so it's great that it has stayed alive in that field and kind of been incubated there. That's how I see it. Like it was kept alive in this field, but now it needs to grow and expand and be applied much more broadly because it's an alternative to the medical model in mainstream psychiatry. And so my passion is to help people see that they're not broken, to see that you don't have to necessarily turn to medication or the medical model, that there's another way. Not that I'm saying medication is bad, don't get me wrong.
No, we're not saying that.
But that it's not the only answer. You know, that we've gotten to a point, at least in the United States, and I know it's not just here, where we're looking for the quick fix, where people are going and saying, oh yes, well, what pill can you prescribe to me? And that's, in psychiatry, that's how it's operating now. But that's not the answer. And I think that comes across really clearly in what a failure our mental health system is right now. Well, there is another way. We can support each other. We can, you know, we need to I mean, we need to change the way our major systems operate in order for this to happen. So obviously, you know,
it'll take innovators. Right, we'll need people like us.
That's right. And so, but yeah, that's my goal, is to bring it to more people and help them see themselves and to see that suffering isn't something to shrink away from, but that you can grow through it and
embrace it, embrace actually, it as difficult as this might, or counterintuitive as this may sound.
And so we need more research. We need to understand better how the theory looks and how, you know, to use it in practice. Like, there's a lot that we don't understand about what he said. You know, one of the things that I've was kind of in the weeds on for a long time, a few years ago, was looking at the differences in the DSM over time and looking at the language he used and just trying to connect it with how we talk about it now, because it just helps bridge the gap. Because when you're reading his original works, they sound old because they are. And so, you know, we just have to make some of these connections and make it easier for people now to understand where he was coming from and make sense of it. But it's certainly not impossible. I mean, we've seen that in, like, in our podcast, we try to talk about it in an accessible way, and we see that it's working. And I would say, like, I would love for you to come join us next year. We had to take a break from recording new episodes because we have a backlog that we have to get out. But I'm going to get you on our schedule if you'll do it.
I'm honored. I'll be honored. Thank you so much for taking the time to tell us more about the theory.
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, do reach out. If you have questions, if you want more information, don't hesitate.
Happy endeavors on researching this more and making it more available for everybody.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, AJ. It's wonderful to be here.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you for being with us today. If you enjoyed the podcast, make sure to subscribe to Innovent Korea on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Special thanks to Millimetric, who composed my music themes. I encourage you to discover his music on Bandcamp. Thank you for listening, and bye for now.